90.7 FM, KPFK. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Restless Soul. My name is Christy Lomax. I'm your host and DJ. I'll be with you until 12 midnight on this beautiful Monday evening in Los Angeles. Tonight, I bring you my special interview with Quentin Harris, who is the hottest man in underground dance music. He seemed to come out of nowhere several years ago and set dance floors on fire with stellar remixes for Motown artists India Arie and Donny. Since then, his relentless output of remixes and original work have earned him a loyal following among DJs on both sides of the Atlantic. I had a chance to talk with Quentin by phone from his New York studio just a few days before making his LA debut as a DJ at Club Deep. But before we get into that, let's listen to his remix of R&B group Jagged Edge and their hit, Walked Out of Heaven. let's get into some of your background right now. I understand that you are originally from Detroit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Let's just give the folks of Los Angeles a little bit of background about you in terms of your musicality. Music a big part of your family life? Did other, your parents or other brothers and sisters play any instruments, anything like that?
Yeah, music was always a part of my family. My mother, she sung, and, my father, he played trumpet, he played, in bands, and he was also a DJ. And, I have an aunt who, at the age of 12, I played in her blues band. I was the keyboardist of her blues band called the Delta Children. My sister used to sing in the choir, and now my brother plays trumpet, my younger brother. So it's like I've always been surrounded by music, all different kinds, you name it, probably heard it in my house.
What instruments do you play?
I'm a classically trained piano player. I play a lot of brass instruments, trumpet, baritone, that kind of thing. I play drums, a little rusty, but I play them. And I'm always trying to look to learn to play new instruments, but unfortunately now, one of the instruments I really would like to learn how to play would be guitar. But because of my schedule, I don't have time to start taking lessons or anything like that. So.
The music that you grew up with, I mean, it's classical, it's jazz, it's funk. When did you first start down the road of music production?
I would say I started when I was, I really got interested in it when I was about 12 or 13. My uncle, he was an aspiring hip-hop artist. And because I knew how to play piano, and I would do these sessions and come up with this, these different ideas and stuff. They say they like that, or they don't like that, or, And at the time, I didn't know exactly what it was called that I was doing. Because pretty soon I started, coming up with ideas and bringing it to them. And it was just I didn't know that at the time that was what I was calling was being a producer. But,
What was the time of the year? This was mid-80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mid-80s.
So the equipment at the time was the SB-12s and, that kind of stuff?
SB-12s, doing step editing on a 909, that kind of stuff.
So unbeknownst to you as well, though, you were working with a lot of some of those classic house sounds for sure.
Yeah.
And so what was the name of your uncle's hip-hop group?
So funny, at the time, they've gone through so many names, but at that particular time, it was called the Motown Posse.
The Motown Posse. Yes. Okay. And did they have some...
Yeah, the 80s now.
This is true. This is true. So they were rocking the high top fades and all that good stuff?
Oh, yeah.
So also, did they have some kind of regional success or national success? Whatever happened with that group and all the music that they were making?
Well, they changed their name several times. And then they ended up doing what's called the Miami Bass Sound, which is very popular in Detroit. And they had two hit records doing that. But what happened was they got very, they got typecast. They got pigeonholed in that sound. And it was so, and they wanted to do different things, but no one would take them seriously because of those two records that they did.
They kind of fell away from the business, and then you continued on.
Yeah.
Okay, and so how did you make the move then from hip-hop to dance music?
Well, like I said, how I grew up listening to a lot of different things, I always, see, what you have to understand is in Detroit, the radio there at the time, you heard all of that on the radio. So hip-hop and house music and techno, all that stuff coexisted equally. It wasn't and people who were into hip-hop, they also liked house. So it was just so, it was easy for me to, make that transition. I always was, a hip-hop head, and, I was at Maurice Malone's famous hip-hop shop on 7 Mile all the time. And, you know, I was definitely, you know, known in that world. But then there was also this other side of me that, you know, I like going out to the clubs and I like hearing what was going on as far as house music-wise. So then I started working at a record store called Record Time in Detroit. And that's where I met Mike Huckabee. He was like, you know, one of the buyers there, and he bought a lot of house, and I just started learning so much about artists and, you know, that stuff from him. And basically, I still was doing hip-hop, but I still had this love for house. And then one day, moved to the present, when I finally moved to New York, what brought me to New York, I was in this group called The Mastermind. And I was the DJ of that group and the producer of that group. And we went on a tour, and then after the tour, I decided to take a break from doing hip-hop because I had been doing it so long. I was just like, I want to do something else and see if I could do this. And I guess you can say the rest is history.
Okay, because that's really what I meant when I was saying, you know, how did you go from hip-hop to house? Because I'm originally from New York, so I completely understand what you mean when you say that, you know, the music was on the radio, all the genres kind of blending together. I grew up on Frankie Crocker and WBLS and right. Kiss FM, so I, you know, and KTU, all that stuff. So I, believe me, I know what you mean by that. But I guess it is interesting to hear someone talk about the fact that they were involved with hip hop from the beginning in terms of production, and that they kind of, you know, moved away from it, especially in this day and age when hip-hop music is such a lucrative thing. And again, I'm not saying that you're not, even now in the present, still sort of making beats or working in that genre as, like, you know, Spinna works back and forth between house and hip-hop. But it strikes me very interesting that someone who was in hip-hop at the early stages when it was really burgeoning and starting to bloom, and, you know, all the innovations and things that have come about from the music, you know, that you kind of got pulled in this other direction. It's just, you know, something that I've never heard before.
Yeah, it kept tugging. I got the bug from somewhere, and it kept tugging at me.
What made you actually move to New York?
I had a job that enabled me to travel to New York a lot, and that was another bug I got. Because I love Detroit, and it's where I'm from, but I just was just really intrigued about living in a place where there were so many different cultures and so many, because Detroit is a very segregated at that time, and it still kind of is. It's very segregated. Like, when people have seen the movie 8 Mile, they're like, is it really like that? I'm like, yes, like that. So I wanted to go somewhere where there was, like, tons of people, and plus, me being a budding producer, I wanted to go somewhere where there was a lot more competition. And so one day I would always say, oh, I want to move to New York, I want to move to New York. And then one day I was just like, you know what, you keep telling yourself that you're going to move there. Either you're going to do it or you're not. So I just packed up like 2 flight cases of records and a suitcase of clothes and moved to New York.
Now, you talk about the competition in New York, and we also know that Detroit has a huge music scene. Of course, Detroit is like the home of techno and folks like Moody Man and Carl Craig and Amp Fiddlers, Derek May. But you didn't feel like you could become a part of that Detroit dance scene, or just sort of wasn't interested in that sound at all? I mean, because you sort of had that culture right there. It was really just the diversity of the city that was that wasn't, you know, a big turn on for you?
Well, Detroit, the problem that I found with Detroit was that it doesn't support its own radio. At the time when I moved to New York, it was to the point in Detroit that with radio, if you were from Detroit, they didn't want to have anything to do with you. So it was like it was a thing where they didn't take you serious, and I didn't want to, you know, sit sit in Detroit and sit there and wait and wait and wait till somebody decides to finally take me seriously. And so I was like, well, in order for me to make this happen, I'm going to have to go to where the labels are and where there's a million other people trying to do exactly what I'm trying to do.
So you get to New York, and what's it like for you there? Your new culture, many people. What are your first impressions as a guy from the Motor City in the Big Bad Apple?
My first impression was I felt right at home. I'm very adaptable. I'm an adaptable person. Like, I can fit in pretty much anywhere. So it wasn't a thing of me, like, culture shock or anything like that. But as far as, like, I would say the first 3 years I was here, it was really rough for me financially. I mean, really rough.
Because you didn't have any family or any means of support.
No, I didn't have any family here. I had a few friends here, but, you know, it's like you don't want to depend on your friends. You want to make sure you can do it yourself. And, you know, I just, persevered and saw through.
And so what was it like those? What were your salad days like, Quentin? How did you manage to kind of eke your way through and not turn around with your two record cases and suitcase and head back to New York, Detroit?
I got a 9-to-5 job, and I still was doing my music. I mean, there were those times when I was like, okay, I don't think it's going to work. I should go back to Detroit. But something inside me kept telling me, don't go back, because you need to be here. There's some reason why you need to be here. And I ended up getting a job working for Satellite Records, actually. And I worked there for 3 years, and I was still, you know, I was still in the masterminds, and I was on the cusp when I decided to start making house full time. And I said, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm going to work every day, and I really want to do this, but in order for me to do it and do it correctly, I'm going to have to quit this job because it's taking up too much of my time that I need to be devoting to music. Luckily, I had a partner at the time who
could lend that kind of financial support.
Yes, and actually helped me out.
Yeah, the sugar daddy.
Nah, not quite a sugar daddy.
Or you had a patron of the arts. So let me ask you something. What was the year that you actually moved to New York? What year was that you came to New York originally? I'm just trying to find the time span between when you came to New York and then made the break from Satellite Records. Because I think it's important for people who are trying to follow in your footsteps or whatever dream that they have, just to get a sense of when people, you know, of that time period. Because I think a lot of people go through that. They have a dream that of something they want to attain, and they have to have the 9-to-5 because, you know, hey, that's just life.
Yeah.
And that, it, you know, that voice in the back of their head is constantly nagging at them. Man, this isn't what my heart wants to do, and it's not really what I'm into, and I need to make that change. Or maybe I'm not going to make it. And, you know, you went through that. So I'm just trying to give people a sense of like how long it took you from the time you moved to New York City to when you finally said, you know, I have to go for my dream. What that year was, what that time span was.
That year was 2003, because I initially moved here in 98 is when I moved here. And
okay.
99, 2000.
So 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you decided that you were going to quit Satellite Records, which, you know, again, you're talking a retail job. So already, just to kind of paint the bigger picture, it's not like you were living high on the hog in New York City.
Oh, no.
You know what I mean? So you decided to quit Satellite Records, and you did have that support in your life where you could work on the music full time. And so, what happens there? How did you go from you know, being this unknown guy in New York City making dance music to this breakout producer and remixer?
Well, the first thing that I did was, at the time, there was this guy named Marvin Howell, who he managed this guy by the name of Steve Morales, who produces Enrique Iglesias, and, you know, he's a you know, a major label used to be an A&R. He used to actually share an office with Simon Cowell at BMG. And we hooked up, and it was like the relationship that we had was, you know, one of, like, I guess, artist development or developing a budding producer. But we used to bump heads a lot because he wanted me to be something that I wasn't. And I just couldn't see myself being like a pop producer, even though I could do it. But my heart wasn't there. I didn't want to be that person who got stuck doing one something. You know, I never have been that. So I just really decided to try to focus on getting my name out there doing remixes. And he gave me a CD to remix these two artists that were on Motown. I forget their names at the moment, but on that CD, there was some India RE acapellas on that CD, and I had sat with them. This was like 2 years prior to me quitting Satellite. And I had sat with them for a long time until one day, before I was scheduled to be in at work, it just hit me what I should do with this India RE acapella, which was Ready for Love. And I did it in like few hours before I went to work, and at this time, you know, I'm still going to clubs and stuff like that, and I gave it to a friend of mine who worked at Satellite. His name is Ben Johnson, who worked at Club Shelter, and he gave it to Timmy Regisford, and Timmy Regisford liked the record so much he started playing it, and then he wanted to meet me, so we met, and he was asking me, did I have anything else? And at the time, I really didn't. So I just started remixing every NDRE song that was on that CD. And I did two more after that. And, you know, they went over really well in the club. But, you know, it wasn't anything groundbreaking. But, you know, they were good songs and people liked them. Then I got a call from a guy named Carmen at Fly Life Entertainment in New York. And he had had a showreel from me with hip-hop stuff and some of the NDRE remixes. And he said, you know how much you like NDRE? He was like, well, have you ever heard of Donnie? And I was like, yeah, I've heard of him. He was like, I have his album, actually. He was like, would you want to remix one of his songs? And I was just like, well, which one is it? He told me it was Cloud 9. He told me to come there and pick up the parts. I said yes. And I went and got the parts, and I did the remix in a short period of time because I was really, really into it. And I gave it to Timmy Regisford, and he loved that record so much that he played it 12 times in one night. And I think that was what started the ball rolling.
basically say that Donnie is, you know, one of those "and the rest is history" moments. Because yeah. I didn't even realize that that you had even produced the NDRE tracks before Donnie. My first introduction to you was Cloud Nine, and I think that was probably the case for most people, and that record just put you on the map in a major way, probably because, well, most definitely because Timmy Regisford, who is a legendary DJ of Club Shelter in New York, one of the longest running clubs in New York City, for those that don't know, but I'm sure most of my listeners are aware of that. He is a trendsetter. People talk about the fact that there are no trendsetters and DJs can't break records and things like that anymore, that those sort of glory days of dance music when house DJs ruled the roost in that way are gone. But Timmy Regisford is definitely someone that does have that control. And as much as there's a lot of hateration around Timmy, as well, you know, this is a classic example, and there are many, of him playing a record in a club, beating it to death to the point that it just made Donnie more popular. It made you certainly well known among people and just really gave you loads and loads of opportunity. Listeners, that you're listening to Restless Soul on 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles. My name is Christy Lomax. I'm your host and DJ, and this evening my special guest is Mr. Quentin Harris. He is the it man at the moment in terms of dance music. He is the man who's on everyone's lips in terms of remixes and producing, and he's just really, really hot right now, and it's my pleasure to be talking with you this evening in the midst or sort of the height of your career and popularity. I really appreciate it. Quentin, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is you said that, you know, Timmy asked to meet you, and of course you all now have a much stronger relationship, but what was it, you think, or has Timmy expressed to you what it was about that initial NDRE record that made him actually want to meet you? Because Timmy gets records every day. I'm sure, you know, Timmy's like a rock star. He can't walk down the street or people come to the club and try to give him records and ask him to play it. And, you know, some he plays and some he doesn't. But why do you think after hearing your NDRE remix that he actually physically wanted to meet you?
Well, I will say this much. After knowing him for the time that I know him now, at that time, I didn't know why he wanted to meet me. But I think it had a lot to do with the song and how I let the song sing in the record. Some producers like to, like, what I call, excuse my French, have a hard-on for their production. And their productions overshine the vocalist. And I don't like that. I think that the production and the vocals should coexist. And more so, the vocalist should have more reign over the music, especially if it's a vocal, because you want to hear what they're saying. And I guess that's what he liked about the stuff that I had done, that he wanted to meet me.
Did he actually express those words to you?
Oh, no. Timmy's not that expressive. as far as verbally. I mean, he lets him playing his records, and that speaks for himself.
The other interesting thing I find about you with the with those initial remixes of India and Donnie, and of course you've also gone on to remix folks like Jagged Edge, right?
Yep.
Which are not pop artists per se, but popular R&B artists. And it's interesting how that whole process came full circle for you from, you know, your initial meeting with the guy that at the record label that really wanted to push you to be like a pop producer, but you wound up, while not quite producing Christina Aguilera, you know.
I correct you right there. A lot of people, to let you know some things that people don't know about me, actually. My first major label remix was actually Shakira. And I didn't even know who she was when I got the acapella from that, from Marvin. And it's very what you would call circuity, the record. It shows you that, you know, I can do a lot of different things. But people wouldn't know it was me. If I put it on and played it for you, you'd be like, okay, who did this, Tony Moran? That's what you probably say.
Wow.
But it's, you know, it's me.
Well, then that's really interesting to see that you have come, you know, in that sense that you did wind up going back around full circle and producing, remixing, but certainly making a whole new records from those parts and vocals, popular artists.
Yeah.
So he was right.
I think what it was with me was that the songs. Even though they were popular artists, I really liked the fact about the songs. Because sometimes you have pop records, you have some pop records, and the songs are just like, they're not saying anything. And it's like, when the song says something to you, it speaks so much. Because like even now, it's like if I'm giving a record to remix, and if it has a ton of slang in it, I just don't want to do it because it's like slang in music. It's like so you can like it's disposable. It's like it doesn't stand the test of time. So I try to do records or songs that I feel that will be around for a while.
And so do you feel like you have a specific, like I feel like as I listen to some of your remixes, and then we'll get into your original productions as well, but I feel like as I listen to your remixes, I can identify now, which it only just hit me last night that I feel like, I think I've hooked on to what kind of rhythm or pattern or whatever it is identifies a Quentin Harris remix. But when you go into the process of remixing a record, do you find that there are similarities in your production style or chord progressions or anything like that that sort of define a Quentin Harris sound?
I don't really think so. I know that there's something there. It's funny that you say that because a lot of people will say that I have a sound. And me, I think I have a sound, but it's not totally defined yet. Maybe to people who follow me, they think it is, or they think that there's a sound. But I'll give you a perfect example. Traveling was made before Cloud Nine. Those are two different sounding records by me. And Traveling actually was made like a few years before I even got a chance to do Cloud Nine. So I think I'm always evolving. I go in and try to approach a record differently every time I do it because I listen to the vocal first and then I just really try to feed off of the vocal and what the person's singing about and go from there. I try to basically kind of get in the head of the person who wrote it and try not to bastardize it.
your new records that's out right now, which is one of my favorites, I gotta tell you. I'm really enjoying this. Let's Be Young. It's a fun, high-energy record. It's one of those big numbers in the club, you know, kind of like Strings of Life or Groove LaCord, you know. It really just piques the party, and it's a great record. But I noticed in the credits of the record, you were thanking you know what I'm going to ask you, right? You were actually thanking some people, and you made a reference to someone saying, you know, just when I thought all your records would sound the same.
Yeah, that person who said, just when I thought all your records would sound the same, you come with this, he's sitting right next to me, actually. That's my partner, David. The story behind that record was we were scheduled to go to the Winter Music Conference, and we had our hotel and our flights booked and everything. And the day before we were supposed to leave, he found out that he booked the hotel the right dates but the wrong month. So we had no hotel. And I was just like, me, I don't get mad that often. I don't, you know, I'm not that kind of person that likes to scream and yell. It's like I'm very introverted that way. But I just channeled that. He was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I was just like, didn't even look at him. I just turned on like the equipment and started to work on something, and that's what came out.
Thank you.
let's talk about your studio for a second. What kind of equipment and things for all my tech junkies and studio rats? What are your tools in your studio? What are you working with? Cubase, Pro Tools, Logic? What are you using?
As a computer-based platform, I use Logic, but I still believe in hardware. I still use my ASR10, which a lot of people want to buy every time they find out I have one, but I'll never get rid of it. I have tons of rack mounts, vintage keys and stuff like that. I have a really basic studio setup, but I really like using hardware. I think if you totally work, this is just my personal opinion, if you totally work in a total computer-based platform, I think you're limiting yourself, because I always want to feel and touch something. I've always been like that with music and working in the studio. It's like, you know, you just sit there with a mouse all day and long, but if you can't touch something physically, I get really, you know, I feel like it's like, what's the point?
In terms of your music making, how has being from Detroit influenced anything about, you know, your style, your sound, or, you know, what you bring to your records?
Being from Detroit has really influenced my music a great deal. I grew up listening to a lot of James Brown and Parliament, Funkadelic, things that are really funky. Whereas like in New York, like South Soul records and, you know, big records like that weren't popular in Detroit. So I always like things more stripped down and funkier and raw, basic records, but still have like, you know, a climax to the record. Records I feel need to, like, there needs to be changes in records. Some, you know, I don't like records that just like stay flat for the, you know, especially if it's a vocal on it. It should do something. It should, you know, there should be little nuances in the record and changes. You know, that's what I take from, like, you know, listening to old records growing up as a kid.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed about Let's Be Young as well is that this is the first song that I noticed that you've done, an original production at least, that you are working with horn sounds. Do you plan to do that some more in your production? Because I really think that things like horns and violins, which are instruments that are lost from, you know, R&B and dance music of the past, really make records come alive. Do you plan to do that more often?
Yeah, I am actually, and let me make it clear the record straight, those were horn sounds, yes. Quentin Harris did not play the trumpet on that song. He would have liked to, but I put it together as, you know, because I played in bands, and I layered the record as it was the horn section, and I plan to do that a lot more in some more of my records, showcase a lot of things that I do. Actually, I'm going to actually do that on my album. People are going to be a little bit amazed about some of the things that they hear from me. So to answer your question, yes, I'm going to be utilizing a lot more horns and a lot of stuff like that.
With that statement, people are going to be more amazed at what they hear from you. I mean, obviously, you can't always lay out all the cards on the table, but do you really feel that people think that you're very limited in what you're able to do and the type of work that you can, especially since you are a real musician?
Right. I just, you know, I feel like it's wrong to give everything away instantly. That's just my personal opinion on it. Like, you know.
Okay.
I don't know what else to say about it.
No, okay. No, you know, again, when you say people will be surprised, I always find, you know, I think that's interesting because you are a real musician, so it would make sense that your records will be full and in depth, and, you know, as you continue to make music, that will automatically be a natural thing to happen. I mean, Masters at Work are not making the type of records today that they made, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Right. It's all about evolving.
Exactly. So what's coming up for you in the future as we bring this interview to a close? What projects are on deck besides the album and your December 4th appearance at Deep here in Los Angeles?
My album is coming. Let's see what else besides that. I'm actually working on Mariah Carey right now, which I'm really excited about because I'm getting the opportunity to do a reproduction. I'm trying to change the name for remixing. Tom Olton told me it's whole new production work, so that's what I need to call it. I'm getting an opportunity to work with somebody who I've always wanted to, you know, work on one of her songs. The song is not even on the album. It's going to be re-released for Christmas on a new Emancipation of Mimi album, and I'm really excited about that. Shaggy's album has dropped a couple weeks ago, which I'm excited about that too. And I'm going to actually go back into hip-hop and do some things. So people are going to be on the lookout for that, too.
And do you think that in hindsight now, and I know lots of aspiring producers and remixers are doing this, but do you think that it just worked out for you that remixing R&B folks sort of helped propel you? Do you think that's a good trend to keep doing? Because I know that there are some in the genre that say, you know, why should we be producing these sort of R&B records when, you know, they don't listen to our music, the industry doesn't care about house music anymore, yet we're giving extra publicity to this genre instead of just creating original stuff. Do you think that's something that should continue?
I think I'm not going to say that it's wrong or it's right. What I will say, and I learned this from like Timmy Register, and I learned this from like Tom Moulton and a lot of like people, that it's all about the song. It doesn't matter who's singing it. It's all about the song. If you have a great song, it's just going to propel, the production even more. And that's what I try to focus on. Even with my original work, I try to make sure I have a great song to work with.
Well, there you have it. Quentin Harris, remixer, producer, jack of all trades, a DJ. He'll be DJing here in Los Angeles at Club Deep in December. You can look for his forthcoming work for Mariah Carey, work from Shaggy, as well as his other productions. And apparently he's going back into the world of hip hop. Quentin, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to chat with me. I want you to know that, you know, your music always has a home here. in Los Angeles. And when you come into town in December, I do hope maybe that you can stop by or we'll get a chance to meet in person.
Okay.
Quentin Harris, the man, the sensation. Before we really wrap up this show and this interview, I want to definitely play the song that is just burning up dance floors from coast to coast. And it is my pick for Remix of the Year. This is some phenomenal work from Quentin Harris, and I would be remiss if I did not get this in the mix. It is Quentin Harris's take on the Lela James blues tune, My Joy. Check it. Restless Soul, 90.7 FM, KPFK.
No.
that's going to do it for this edition of Restless Soul. Thanks once again to Quentin Harris, my special guest this evening. And of course, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week for another edition of Restless Soul right here, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org.